On this episode of The Current of Emergency Management, we're talking about summer conferences, summer heat, and wildfire.
Welcome to The Current of Emergency Management.
Welcome back, everyone. We are longer than we hope to be between recordings, but my name is Cody Pound, here with my co-host, Dr. Maribel Martinez-Mejia.
Hello, everyone. We are glad to be recording. It's been, Cody, you know how we have the name of our podcast is The Current. I think it's been like, what is it, Rolling the Rapids? The Current has been just like rapids. It's been a fun summer. It's been a very busy summer.
It's definitely been rapids and not smooth sailing, but it has been fun. So I mean, if you enjoy this work, this is the summer to have been in it.
Exactly.
So with that, our standard disclaimer, Maribel and I are both full-time emergency managers. This podcast is not a part of our normal job duties. So any opinions are our own and not a reflection of our employer.
But what we can say is that Cody does work for a rural jurisdiction and I work on the regional emergency management side.
So this summer, where did we begin? So our last episode, and we took a month off, we had announced to everybody. And I think that we had really hoped that we would have had one out at the 1st of August, but we're a couple weeks behind, but that's the kind of the life of our work, right?
Right. This summer just flew. I can't believe we're mid-August. It's just crazy. This year is flying. But like you said, it's been fun. It's just been busy.
So one thing with, and on top of people asking when the next episode is going to come out, one of the questions I've gotten, and I know you've gotten a lot, is at the TDEM conference last year, we were able to interview Chief Kidd from TDEM. And a lot of people have asked why we didn't do that this year also. So we wanted to take a second to explain. When I say that we did everything we could to make that interview happen, and by we, that includes Chief Kidd. So
he did. He did try.
Giving credit where credit is due, Chief Kidd and myself and Maribel were in constant communication that week, and it was, what about in an hour? What about tomorrow at 10? What about... And between the three of us, we were not able to carve out an hour. So
I love conferences, but they're also just so busy. You're meeting people, you have committee meetings, you're giving talks. It's just, they're fun, but they're nonstop. And like you said, we really did try. We were really trying to give an update on the current, everything what TDEM is doing. But unfortunately we were not able to.
And that was a three-way conversation. We did try, but one of the disadvantages, I guess, in terms of trying to record a podcast is that the TDEM conference is also a really good place for a lot of state meetings, committee meetings and stuff to happen. You know, Maribel being, in a regional position, then she has obligations to be at a lot of those. I'm on some of those state committees, so obviously have obligations to be there. Chief Kidd is on some of those committees. And then in addition to that, there were some other ones that both Maribel and I were at, and it just did not work out this year. We are looking to try and set up an interview at some point. Hopefully we can do that. We'll let you know. But we made every effort and we tried and just weren't able to make it happen.
Absolutely. I'm hoping this fall, whether it's another TMAC meeting or if it's just something that you and I, Cody, go down and meet with Chief Kidd, we hope to get that done before the end of this year.
Well, and it may have been a good thing because a lot of changes in TDEM even since the conference. And so some of those are still shaking out. If you're not a Texas listener, we won't dive into that too much. But I think that being able to talk to him later in the year this year may have been a blessing in disguise.
Absolutely. We'll get him after the rollout of September 1st. So that'll be good to catch up on those items.
Speaking of conferences, though, the TDEM conference in Fort Worth this year, that's new. And then we've had, I think between the two of us, we've been to a fairly decent amount of conferences this year. What else did you attend this year, Maribel?
The other big one was a National Homeland Security Conference in Chicago. That was, I always love the Homeland Security Conferences. They're a little bit different flavor than the State Emergency Management or their IAEM, National Emergency Management Conference. Really brings in emergency management, law enforcement, fire, and Chicago did a wonderful job in, you know, displaying their equipment. They had several demos, the tours. I was able to be on a panel for one of the talks. It was just overall a really great conference.
And I will say this year, I'm happy to say that I missed the Homeland Security Conference.
You went to a different one.
Well, no, that was family vacation.
Oh, that was vacation time.
That was vacation. Okay. So me and the family went to Florida for, I think it was Thursday through Monday. And so just, I mean, great, great time down there. We spent most of our free time at the beach. You know, Mattis has been to a beach before, my five-year-old. But really, this is the, you know, that age of where he's probably going to remember. It wasn't just, you know, pictures of a holding a two-year-old in the water, but it was great. I sent you the picture of when he found a coconut.
Just an expression on his face was like, ah, so happy.
My wife said it best. If you want to know what a picture of pure joy looks like, you know, then that was it.
Well, I am glad you got to take a break and enjoy family time and make those special memories, because that's what he'll remember. So that's always good to do.
Yeah, that was a good time. So although I did want to be able to be at the Homeland Security Conference this year, I was not sad that I missed it. It was a good reason to miss, and certainly enjoyed the time off and the break.
That's good. And then, but after that, you went to another conference. Is that correct?
It was right before. Okay. I think I was gone for that one for 3 or 4 days, and then home or back for like 2, and then we left for Florida. And that was the NACO conference, National Association of Counties. Have you ever been to that one?
I have not. I've heard about it, and I sometimes get their email updates, but I have never been to one. What kind of information do they have?
Well, it was interesting. It was in Texas this year, and so that's a big reason why I was able to go. And it was one of those, you know, I wasn't sure what all I would get out of it. I will say, I don't know that I'll have it in the budget every year, because obviously it moves around the country, but I will definitely keep that on the radar to go to in the future. That was a good conference. We can probably talk about this a little bit. I don't know that we've ever really dove off into the political side of our job. Mm-hmm. And this is the policy, this, you know, primarily county commissioners, county judges, a lot of county treasurers, a lot of elected officials. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is, obviously, as an EM, I was a bit of an outsider there, because they would see, you know, your name badge and, oh, emergency management. But what was interesting is the amount of questions that they asked me. People that I would meet. Uh-huh. And, oh, you know, and so tell me about emergency management. And so one of the cool things that it did, and I wish I remembered all the jurisdictions, is I was actually able to do a lot of advocating for the EM profession with other elected officials across the country. Mm. And if any of your elected officials say, I met this guy, then one of the things that I always told him is, I don't need to know the size of your EM. They are underfunded and understaffed.
Nice. Way to plug in EM.
Yeah. And of course, all of them would laugh, and they said, well, isn't every office? And I said, no, but not as much as your EM office, I assure you. Yeah. So that was really a kind of a good, I saw that as a good thing, and it made me think, you know, in the EM community as a whole, should we seek that kind of stuff out, if nothing more than for a chance to be with other elected officials from, you know, from different jurisdictions and be that advocate for our profession?
Yes, because county judges, I mean, those are the designated emergency management directors, right? At least in the state of Texas. And so it's good to have that visibility for emergency management.
I did meet a fellow podcast host. I'll give him a plug here. It's called The Good Government Show. privately owned. He's not a government employee. And it was interesting to get to just chat with him about how he started his podcast. And he said, there's plenty of people who talk about all the things government does wrong. And I just figured we would give a platform for people to talk about the good things government's doing.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
And so still in communication with him, we may collaborate and have him on at some point. But it's a good show. I've listened to it. And it really is. It's tell us who you are, what you do, and tell us about the good things that government's doing in your jurisdiction. And so it's an interesting podcast to listen to.
I'll have to look him up.
But, you know, you see, I was able to see a lot of how policy is done and how organizations like NACO advocate for, and of course, NACO is for National Association of Counties, but advocate on behalf of counties at the federal level. And so it was really good seeing that process. And then I also worked very closely with TAC, the Texas Association of Counties, while I was down there. And then that's the same thing. I mean, they are our state advocates. They help us with a lot. They're our risk pool, our insurance pool, you know. And so just kind of getting into the process of learning more about county government, that was a big eye-opener for me.
Wow, that's really good. So they do this annually, and they just kind of shift it everywhere around the U.S.?
They do. Year. Yeah, and I'm trying to remember. I think there's a pattern to it, but that somebody explained to me, but I don't remember that pattern. You know, southern, eastern, west, north, right. You know, kind of thing. I can't remember if it's next year or 2 years from now. It's going to be in Florida. They kind of move it all around the country. Another thing that I found, NACO obviously had a huge booth there set up. One of the things that was at the booth was funding sources for renewable energy. Mm. It was like a 4-page pamphlet. And by pamphlet, I mean full page. And it was just grant after grant after grant program for renewable energy.
For the counties or for individuals?
For well, I didn't dig through every single one of them, but it was primarily funding sources. So it was the kind of thing, if on your mitigation plan you've got, you know, any energy resilience type projects, then there's your sources to look for.
Right.
And so there, I found out that they are a good source to look to for aggregating a lot of information that may be valuable to our community.
No, that's perfect. And, you know, energy resilience is a very hot topic. I know we're going through a very hot summer this year, and it's just, you know, it's really taking a toll on our infrastructure and some of the operations. But like you said, it has a great tie-in back to hazard mitigation. I know that's something that we as a region also are looking at into different projects. But, you know, that's interesting to hear. I'll have to follow up with you more on it later to see what all we can do.
And speaking of hot summers, that's a good segue, unplanned. Good job, Maribel. on the summer that we've had, you're the meteorologist, so you may be able to spit off a little better data of what our summer in the North Texas area has been like.
I don't know about being a meteorologist, but I just pulled it up on formerly Twitter, now X, and from our weather service. So there you go. That's a meteorologist.
The platform formerly known as Twitter.
There you go. Formerly Twitter. But yes, summer 2023, amongst the driest on record. So right now we're ranking in our area. Again, we're in Texas. The number 4 driest summers ever for the year. How much rain do you think we've had for the year?
For the year. I don't know, 4 inches? Is it that low?
No, less than that. 1.25.
For the whole year?
Yeah, it says the year 2023. That seems kind of low. Maybe it's for just through August. Oh, June 1 through August 31st. There you go. Just for the summer. 1.25 inches.
Wow.
That's not a lot. Yeah.
Not a lot. And the heat.
Oh, yes. 109, 110. It's just, yeah.
I think it's 110 right now.
Quite warm.
Yeah. So
if you give Texas, everybody just talks about it. It's hot out there. Yeah, it's hot out there. It's just hot out there.
El Paso set a record for consecutive days of 100-degree heat, I think it was. And it and by set a record, I mean shattered it. I think it doubled the previous record.
Oh my. I thought it was funny because last week we had a cold front come in and it cooled down by 10 degrees. So everybody was just loving 98, 97 degree weather. They're like, oh, this feels so good.
And in our part of the world, with the intense heat also brings the wildfire danger.
Yes. And you have been quite busy with that.
It has been.
As well as many other emergency managers in our area.
It has been. So here's where, to give you a picture, this is a real story. I'm not making this up. I think it was about a week ago. We had a thunderstorm system move through the northwestern portion of our region. The Civil Air Patrol was following the storm, flying behind it to watch for the cloud to ground lightning strikes because of the wildfire. So our heat and our dryness and our vegetation is in such a state now that thunderstorms are actually a fire danger.
Right.
That's where we're at. And there was a lot of cloud to ground lightning with that system. It actually did start several fires. So that's the point that we're at, is that the rain that comes with the thunderstorm isn't helping. It's the thunderstorm starting more fires.
I know everybody gets excited. Ooh, there's a storm on the radar, and you're probably just cringing. Oh, there's lightning with that storm.
Well, not only that, it's the follow-up. A lot of people who, you know, burn brush piles and stuff, you know, we have a lot of rural areas. Mm-hmm. And it's a lack of understanding that the day after it rains is not better conditions to burn your brush pile, because right. Now the brush trucks trying to get to the fire to put it out are going to get stuck. So it's a misunderstanding for sure of the conditions. Dead fuel is dead fuel. Rain doesn't bring it back to life. Especially when you have wind, it dries out very quickly. Most of that moisture that comes, it's going to soak into the ground, but only the top portion of the ground. So it just makes conditions more difficult to fight the fire, but it doesn't really do much to help keep it from happening.
Right. And you've had several large ones. I know you had been working. You had several counties assist you with fires. What other emergency management considerations do you deal with if you do have a wildfire?
A big one, and you know, this speaks a lot. I think if we go way back to when we first started the podcast, one of the first episodes we did is looking at the difference between rural and urban, the emergency management. And one of the big things for us in when the first report of a wildfire, we are very involved early. I say involved. We're very aware early on. We do most of the resource tracking for the incident commander on scene from the EOC.
Once you have a fire going, right? Or do you have kind of like a library or kind of a status of all the fire apparatus in your county?
So that's why we track, actually, because we're, you know, my county is primarily, we only have one paid department and then the rest mm-hmm. are all volunteer. So from a dispatch standpoint, in, you know, previous jurisdictions where I worked as a firefighter, if I was riding engine 2, for example, when dispatch would tone us out, they would tone out engine 2. And so it's tracked at the apparatus level. So having a full understanding of what resources you have in route is pretty easy, because that's how they're tracked at dispatch.
Good.
When you're dealing with volunteer, that's not necessarily the case. Right. So if they tone station 17, for example, they don't know if brush 17 or engine 17 or tanker 17 or commands, they don't know who's going to respond.
Wow.
And there's no MDT. So it's all done through the radio. So they tone out the station, and then it's that department who comes back over the radio and says which apparatus is en route.
So you have to be actively listening to the radio to determine who is responding and then track those resources.
Correct. So on high fire danger days, and when we're in conditions like we are now, we track from the initial call. Mm-hmm. But then we also deal with the issue of it's not paid full-time people. People aren't in the station waiting for a call.
Right.
And so if you tone out station 10, station 11, and station 12, Station 11 may call you back and say, we don't have anybody available. And so now it's another station that needs to be toned, and so on and so forth. But there's also no way of really for the dispatch center to know if there's anyone left in the house to be able to take a medical call.
Wow. What is your trends? I mean, for your experience with volunteers, are y'all having a hard time getting volunteer firefighters, or are those numbers pretty good still?
No, that's a struggle.
Really?
Yeah, that's a struggle. And I, honestly, I maybe in the Northeast where it's kind of a different mindset. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anyone who would say, no, we got more volunteers than we know what to do. It's a struggle for everyone. Right.
So then you really kind of rely on Texas Forest Service and your mutual aid partners who are non-volunteer, right?
So some of that depends on the time of day and then also the day of the week. So weekends, you're going to get a lot more volunteer response. 11 o'clock in the morning, that's a rough time.
Yeah.
There are
most of your wildfires can be around like 2 to 3 if it's a red flag day, right? When you have lower humidity or you have people out and about or burning or whatever.
Typically, early afternoon, noon is when we really are paying real close attention. And then as we get into later into the day, as the humidity drops, sometimes the wind starts to pick up, and that's when it gets real squirrely. It's typically after a long day. And it's 4:30.
You're trying to walk out the door.
That's when we can tell based on the tones, on the number of stations being toned. Hmm. Because if it's two tones, it's going to be an ambulance in a fire station. But then when you hear that third one, it might be a car wreck. But then when you hear that fourth one, it's like, oh, here we go.
Oh, man.
But we do rely on Texas Forest Service quite a bit. Great partners. They have
air assets too.
Right? Correct. And they've got a lot of air assets on standby right now.
That's good. What about, I had it and I lost it. Oh, evacuations. So you've dealt with a few evacuations as well.
We have. So what we do from the EOC for, and this is us, every jurisdiction is going to be different. Then typically, if it's going to be anywhere near homes, then what the IC on scene will do is draw a quote-unquote line in the sand. If the fire reaches this point, then we're going to evacuate, up to this point. And they're letting us know that ahead of time. And what we're doing in the EOC mm-hmm. is pre-drawing maps, basically,
good.
And getting those ready to post on social media and to get the word out. And right. that way it's not we need to evacuate and now we're starting with the process of figuring that out. But also,
and I know life safety is top priority, but you're also in the back of your mind thinking FMAG, right?
Yes. And we just hit that a couple of weeks ago, hit that threshold. Mm-hmm. But the standard for that is it's pretty high.
Yeah, it is, right? You had to have how many homes or structures are impacted. And I know there's a lot of considerations into that. But that's to bring in additional state resources, right?
Well, for the most part, it's to bring in funding.
Money, right.
Yeah, you start looking at reimbursement for that. But there's a lot of factors. The one, that it's a decision that has to be made very quickly because you have to be as close to 0% contained as possible at the point that you declare. And so you've really got to evaluate that quickly. We use a GIS platform to turn on our structure layers so that we can go in there and get an accurate count of how many values do we have at risk, the potential for evacuation, evacuation routes. And so all of that comes into play pretty quickly. And that's one of the things that we look at early on. It's also from the EOC, we're almost, if you're on an incident management team, we're almost in some ways like the situation unit. Mm-hmm. And so we're feeding a lot of information back to the IC. We're pulling spot weather reports, tier 2 reports. If we have any tier 2 facilities in the area, then we're letting them know that, pulling the tier 2 data to let them know what the risk is. We're looking at the number of values at risk. If they need more, then we're also serve as the resource center. So once our EOC is active for a fire, then the EOC becomes the resource request center. So they don't request it through dispatch anymore. They request it through the EOC.
That's a lot of work. And I know you have a small person shop right there with the being a rural county. So do you bring in additional people from the county to support your operations, or is it just the two of y'all working it?
Well, two additional. So there's three total.
Okay.
But yes, so we will bring in some other people from the county. I have one of my commissioners actually is a regular in the EOC. The county judge is a regular in the EOC.
That's good.
We have our facilities director comes quite a bit. He's kind of ad hoc logistics. he is real good at getting stuff. So
yeah, that's the perfect person to have your logistics, right? He's the facilities and probably equipment as well.
Right. So if we need most common one recently has been blown tires. And so we're
really on fire apparatus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've replaced two or three. I can't remember in the last couple of weeks. We've had to call a company that will go out and be able to replace tires in the field. Oh, it's not cheap either, by the way.
I bet not.
Yeah. It's depending on the type
close
of tire.
To wildfires too.
Right. Yeah. Depending on the tire, it's about $500 pop. And that's just one tire that they're replacing, but, doing it in the field. So he'll come in. There have been times that we've had EMs from other jurisdictions who have come in. Typically, that is when there's a lot of apparatus from that jurisdiction, like another county.
Right.
That just kind of helps because then I don't have to call them.
Right.
I can just, hey, you got any more, do you have any more fire apparatus from your county that you can send? And then they're coordinating that and it saves a phone call.
That's help. Yeah. That's a big help.
So yeah, that's, we do quite a bit. We funnel that information back. We're constantly tracking those resources. We're in constant communication with TFS about what they have available. And then that's one of the reasons why the resource request will go through the EOC is because we're talking to our neighbor counties and we know Absolutely. What they have. A lot of times we're pre-staging. Is that the word, pre-staging?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, didn't that change, that term change recently?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I always still call it pre-staging.
So when they request additional, an additional strike team, we typically already have, we know what the next up strike team is.
That's good.
And then one of the things we're also doing is monitoring who is, it kind of happens at the same time. When you know who is at the fire, then you know who's not in their station. And so we're paying attention to which stations have been sent to the fire because we need to also consider the fact that other emergencies will happen.
Right.
And so there are times that we're, in some cases even dispatch before, maybe right before we get involved and they tone somebody down and we say, nope, jump that station, go to the next one because that we have too big of a gap in the county.
That's good to have that situational awareness right there in the EOC. So no, that makes perfect sense. I know that's something that we have done before, just resource management in the EOC for visibility and, having your fire team there also as well to help coordinate the response. So that's awesome.
Well, and that we still track on paper with a paper map.
Yeah. But you're always in communication with incident command, right? So they also have visibility.
We do. We're constantly feeding that to them. We've tried to replicate that process digitally and we haven't been able to.
Yeah,
we've tried multiple times with multiple different platforms because it's basically a big map of the county by fire district, and there's all the apparatus in each district is got a colored sticker on the map. When we take that sticker off and put it over on the board saying that they're on that fire, then there's a blank sticker behind it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything on it, so it tells us what's missing from that district. So it gives us the ability to see in real time, like what's left to cover the district and like what all's missing. It also helps with mutual aid. That's actually
kind of like the Lean Sigma technique, isn't it? Is that kind of where you learned that? through. It seems like that's, I've heard kind of the same concept with tools. Is like you have it blank, so you know what tools you're missing. So you always should have them all organized. So it seems like the same concept is you leave that blank so you know what's in and out.
Yes, yes. That's a good point. I don't know if I remember when I was researching, reading a couple of different things, and that may have been where I read that, but mm-hmm. the initial idea of needing to know what's left actually came not from a tracking on a fire stand situation. It was when I was out of town and I got a call from a fellow EM needing a tanker mm-hmm. and from in another county. And we had two fires going, but since we didn't know what was there, we didn't know if we had enough tankers to be able to send one out of the county.
Oh, wow.
And so it was just as important for us to know what's not available as it was for us to know what's on the fire, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's what we've tried to replicate digitally, but we just haven't been able to.
I'm sure there's a way, but you know, when you're on site in the field by fire, I mean, it's hard, right? You're dealing with Wi-Fi issues. You're dealing with the dynamic scene. You probably don't have a command vehicle out there in the rural areas. Unless it's a huge fire, then you'll have one. But I mean, it's pretty rough going.
Well, we're doing that from the EOC.
Right.
And the reason that we wanted to replicate it digitally is so that that information is shared with the IC in real time. And so that would be the point of trying to replicate that process digitally, but we haven't been able to. And so instead, it's just every couple of minutes, we have a share folder set up and we can share a link into that folder. And so that's where we drop all the spot reports, tier two reports, all that kind of stuff.
Perfect.
And then, so what we're just doing is constantly updating that resource list.
Gotcha.
Ideally, it would be best if as we're tracking it, they're getting that information in real time. Also, there's a way, we just haven't found it yet.
Right. Probably something more custom that you have to do, right?
Yeah. And we've tried with Smartsheets and with Google. We got real close actually with Google using Google Slides. It was like a PowerPoint mm-hmm. kind of thing. But there were still a couple of problems with why it wouldn't work. And we also needed to be fast because that information is coming in very quickly.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the younger EMs, it's a foreign process to them, but paper and pen still works really good, you know.
Everybody knows paper and pen. Right.
Funny side note, have you ever trained on that? I had a...
Trained on what? Paper and pen?
Right.
Like, what's there to train on?
You know, it's funny. This was a conversation I had when people were talking about the backup is always paper and pen. And then, you know, but you got to train on that. If all your systems go down, you have to train on it. I'm like, do you?
I mean, you may have the forms in your EOC, then they're just doing it on the form, right? Like a 213 or 214, something like that. But other than you're just taking notes or timelines, or you may have a timeline type of form.
That's kind of what I thought. I'm like, do you need to practice writing? I don't, like, how do you train on your backup, which is paper and pen? I don't know.
I don't know.
Train on making a phone call?
Surely not. Unless it's a weird type of phone system where you have to dial 9 or dial 8 to get out or something like that, but. Or you have those phones that are integrated with your radio, right? Although those are fairly simple to use still. But
yeah, I mean, certainly training.
It's still good review training.
Yeah, I mean, training on your backup systems, I guess. But like, if everything goes down and you're back to paper and pen, I don't know. I don't know if you need to train on that.
Maybe it's how to get that out to others that would be in the digital system. So still keeping that copy operating picture. What are you doing with the documents you're creating?
Sure.
Maybe. I don't know.
But in some instances, I've wondered just through conversations with different EMs at times and the different documents they're creating. And I've asked a few, like, well, but why? What are you doing with it?
Yes. I think we really like to just record everything, and you should, right, to an extent. But sometimes I think we do stuff that is kind of useless or pointless, or just because I don't know.
It seems like the thing, I don't know, you heard somewhere that you were supposed to.
Yeah. We're supposed to do that. But why? But why?
Yeah. I ask why.
Just know the why.
Yeah. We ask why a lot. And if we don't have an answer, we don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I know timelines are very important. Those, I'd always go back, you know, if you're doing an after action report, or if you get asked from your leadership, or you have to brief on the situation, you know, having a good timeline of actions taken when things were deployed is always great to have.
Do you, when you were still running in the EOC, do you do an incident log?
Or yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'd have a person in our planning team specifically doing that, because it's, yep, again, it's something that you just go back and reference a lot.
Yeah, we do the same thing. We have one person who's the incident recorder. And anything that's significant for the incident itself. So
right.
Social media post goes out, then they're supposed to be recording time.
Good.
You know, if we made a notification to an elected official, then I mean, anything relative to the incident itself, yes, then we have one incident log. One person keeps it. There's no having to go back and review and match it up afterwards. So right, that's helped quite a bit.
Right. When you did public warning, I know that's a major deal. I know you have social media, you do press releases. As a county, do you have wireless emergency alerts or IPAWS system, or you work with the Weather Service to do your evacuation civil emergencies alerts?
No, we don't have IPAWS. We could, but we don't. And that's probably, we could probably go a whole episode about that. But for the most part, well, and I'm one of the rare few, I'll probably throw a grenade into the community here. We actually allow our local media in the EOC.
Wow.
I know that sounds crazy. And by local media, it's the county newspaper. And that happened organically. That wasn't planned. I don't even remember the incident. I'm trying to think. It's not just dead noise. It didn't just cut off, but I can't remember. There was a lot. I think it was a fire, now that I think about it. Mm. And there was a lot of, so it was a fire. I remember that now. Communication, that fire was big enough that the state interop channels on scene weren't working. So it was spread out to the point the vision couldn't get a hold of command. Because they had gotten too far apart. Mm-hmm. And so there was kind of an information flow gap that happened. And then once communication had been reestablished, then the fire was close. We needed evacuation. So there was a lot going on in a very, very short period of time. And our local paper has always been very good about helping get information out. And so he was trying to get information, and I was like, I'm too busy. Where are you? Come to the EOC.
And so by newspaper, you're talking about they were getting information out. I'm assuming they're not waiting for the next newspaper. They're doing it by social media.
Right. And their social media following, they're the only paper in my jurisdiction. So their social media following is huge. Mm-hmm. More than ours, which is secretly that's a challenge for us, right? We're trying to catch them, but they've still got more people following them. So it's, you know, in my mind, it's the public interest for them to help us get that information out, because they're going to hit people that aren't following us on social media.
Right.
And so they were trying to help get information out, but I'm still collecting information. Everything was crazy. And I said, are you in Decatur? Because their office isn't very far from where the EOC is. And he said, yes. I said, come to the EOC. And then when he got there, I was like, you don't publish anything without permission. You're here to help us get information out. That's it. And he said, no problem.
So essentially he's your PIO.
Well, to a point, because he's not dealing with media requests or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But and he came, and I mean, it wasn't a problem. All of the information they were putting out was just factual. And it was like 6 months before he asked if he could include what, you know, that in a story that he wrote. Mm-hmm. And so he wasn't there to get it, you know, be in the inside track to collect information for a story. It wasn't like secretly gathering. And so it kind of worked. So then we tried mm-hmm. it again, and it's worked every time, and it's never been a problem. So they come,
that's
they
good. Always, at least it works for you. Cause I mean, it depends on the person. It depends on your operations. It depends on your community, right?
Sure.
It wouldn't work for a lot of jurisdictions, but I'm glad it's working for you.
And it's easy because it doesn't, you know, I'm being a government employee, you have to be worried about fairness, mm-hmm. you know, but they're the only local media. They're not coming to the EOC to get a story. They're coming to the EOC to get information out through their social media. Mm-hmm. And so since it works that way and it's worked well and they help us get information out, then it, you know, it continues to work and we allow it. And so as long as there's not a problem, it's like, why would we not try and get information out?
Right. Right. Cause there can be instances right where you don't want to share, but if there's that understanding there that, hey, no, I know we're not going to share it, then that's great because I think you get more good in the long run having them there. Like I said, I'm so glad it works for you, but I know in a lot of places it would not work just because of that competition in different media resources.
Well, and trust is a big part of it too.
Right.
You know, I think anyone in government service is always got a trust factor that exists with dealing with media at times, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not all media. The problem is a few bad apples that have ruined that trust for a lot of people in government service. But, you know, kind of everybody's always seems a little on edge, like they're looking for that gotcha moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an EOC is a hectic time. It needs to be a safe place for people to vent and you know, there's some interesting things said in an EOC, I think.
Yeah, at the heat of the moment. Yeah.
Right. You don't need to be worried that somebody's secretly recording.
Right, right.
So
that's I'm glad it works, and I'm glad your judge is good with it as well. Like I said, I think it's helping build that relationship and that trust within your county.
And we have QR codes for a lot of our storm shelter registry. And to sign up for alerts, we have different QR codes that are set up for that. Our paper runs those almost weekly, and we never asked them to. We don't pay for it. They mm-hmm. it's like if they have space, they run them, and so they really do help a lot. We have a great relationship with our local media. And that's not, you know, always typical, but we're fortunate there.
Good.
But no,
build your community preparedness. That's what you're aiming for, is community resilience and community preparedness, because you want people to be prepared to listen and take heed of the evacuations or shelter in place notices. And so that's all good.
We also we never have, you know, not to say there's not time, but we don't do mandatory evacuations. It's voluntary. And so, you know, getting into the WIA and stuff, it's a lot better a lot of times for somebody to knock on your door and say, hey, you know, we're asking everybody to evacuate, the fire's getting close, or whatever the case may be. And again, probably a topic for multiple episodes on that one, the mandatory evacuation. I don't know, in your experience, did you ever preside over the EOC for mandatory evacuations?
I did when I was up north. That was very early on. And then, of course, when you can and can't do it. And we ended up going with just calling it an evacuation, not voluntary or mandatory. But again, same with you. For just having the law enforcement go door to door, and it's like, hey, wildfire or whatever's coming, we need to get you out of there. And you had some people refuse, and they're like, okay, we need your name and address, you know, put it on your arm in case they need to identify you. I mean, I'm sure that's something that your law enforcement officers do as well. You can't make them leave, I don't believe, unless they have kids. But I know that was always a hot topic, but for the most part, people would evacuate. I mean, it was in their best interest, right? You're not doing evacuation orders every day. It's right. Once a year type of deal.
Well, and kind of along the same lines, when you say something is mandatory, then you've got to at least consider the question of, well, what are you going to do if I don't? Mm-hmm. And if our answer to that is we're really not going to do anything, we're not going to call it mandatory.
Right.
And so the one thing I think in Texas that you get under legal protection is that if you do call a mandatory evacuation and then you have to go and save somebody who opted not to evacuate, they can be held civilly liable for the cost of that rescue. Mm-hmm. And so, but then that question too is, how do you track the cost and are you going to go after them civilly?
Right.
And I think for the most part, we're not going to do anything criminal. And so it's like, well, like, why even put yourself in the position to have to defend that to somebody if they want to challenge you on it?
Right.
And so if in reality, at the end of the day, it's voluntary anyway, then just say that. That's kind of our stance.
So do you say voluntary evacuation or you just call it evacuation? We just felt that.
We're evacuating this area. We recommend evacuation. We recommend that you evacuate.
Highly recommend.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So. We noticed the same thing. If we said voluntary, people were like, oh, well, that's just kind of, maybe there's a danger, maybe not. But if we just say evacuation, highly recommended, then that put a little bit more heat than a mandatory, which we really couldn't call mandatory. So.
Right. I mean, you need a declaration. The judge would have to sign the order in Texas. The judge would have to sign the evacuation order. There's also a delay, too, right? So that line in the sand is further away from where those homes are if you're going to make it mandatory. Mm-hmm. Because then you have a legal process in place to make it mandatory. And so, you're starting that earlier. Well, now you run the risk of telling people to evacuate when they didn't need to. And now next time you tell them to evacuate, well, last time nothing happened.
Yeah. And we had, again, if we knew those big, bad wildfire days or big, bad flooding days, we would have, our legal team, our PIO, our city management, the judges there. So if we had to do any evacuations, it was very quick. They were pre-drafted and ready to go.
I'm going to laugh at you about your legal team.
You had to have legal, especially with larger jurisdictions. It's just nice to have that coverage. And they're just everywhere that I've worked that, we've had the legal team. They've been really awesome. They're like, oh, let's do this. I mean, to have the contracts in place. I mean, everything's in order. It's always good to have, their opinions on, can we do this? Can we not? It just protected the EOC and our jurisdiction. But we're still like, everybody was there to help others, right? So it was there to help the community and make sure that everything was on cue so we could, request resources or do whatever and do it in a timely manner.
Oh, no, it sounds awesome. I'm just curious what it's like. Have a whole legal team.
That's why your EOC, sometimes EOC teams could be like 30, 50 people, or COVID was like
30 or 50 100. People. This is hilarious. Keep telling me. Keep telling me about it.
Yeah, not your three.
Three.
Although wildfires, we were dealing with massive, wildfire issues. I remember back to the 2011 days, we had a big planning fire team. And so that was a cadre of about 15 firefighters that would do, again, it was emergency management for the jurisdiction and then two different counties. And they would coordinate with all the volunteer agencies. And then our regular wildfire EOC team was about 20, 25. So it was nice to have everybody.
So the EOC team was non-firefighter, so 15 firefighter and then 25 non-fire?
Yes. So that would be the department heads, some of the county assets, road and bridges. We would have TxDOT there. We would have community services if we had to do any reception areas, if we did have to evacuate, of course, PD, fire. It was a good crew.
Yeah, sounds that way.
It was nice. So that's what we were talking about. I was like, yeah, we had to do what? Which was it? Five? I was like, that's a lot of work for five individuals.
If five, if we're lucky. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the three of us on staff and then Jimmy, who is our facilities director. Those are that's the core group right there. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes weather service would come in. So if they detect something or, we running on a call, they were like, okay, this is our winds. And we would display that in the EOC. So it was nice. Everybody knew, okay, if this grows, our GIS team could, pull up a map and say, this is the impacted area. This would be the impacted area.
Say that again. Your GIS. Your GIS. What?
He would map the point and then
GIS team.
Well, it depends on what type of, right? If it was a red flag day and we knew it was going to be, you know, relative humidity is less than 10 for 5 hours and winds, you know, 30, 35. That's a big concern for us because wildfires would be going really quick. So then they would bring, a team of, I don't know, 3 to 5, work with the fire department. And we had some people in the fire department that were great GIS people too. So it was nice. They would coordinate with incident command. We had a command vehicle go out and scene, and they would you know, communicate back and forth. So it's, you know, in 2011, like I said, we activated the EOC about 67 times, and it was just so dry, and we had several big wildfires. One particular one on February 28th, we actually had quite a bit of homes, even though we were pre-activated, right? We still had a lot of homes burned down, and it was tough, but you know, we were at least ready and there and ready to respond. And even with that, it was just one of those days where wildfire goes and was it 3 football fields a minute? It was just fast growing wildfires.
Yeah. The Forest Service uses CPA chains per hour.
Chains
per minute, I think.
Do you know what modeling software they use?
Ooh, I think it's just Esri.
Or is it just they just do it like they take in the wind consideration and just kind of do their own?
The Forest Service. So if you're, especially if you're an EM in Texas and you haven't talked to your TFS GIS people, you should have that conversation. They have a lot of really good information in GIS.
And they have a fire table too that they can bring in, right? And you can do kind of like an exercise with your teams.
Yeah, it's a sand table.
Yeah.
And so they project a, it's like real-time imagery with fire modeling and stuff on it. And the purpose of the sand is you can do real topography. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can draw in it and stuff like that, but you don't have to use the sand. And that software is available online as well. So we've done some fire modeling. And they tell you it's not a planning tool. You know, you don't use it to try and plan, but I think that's a disclaimer. But it's a training tool. And so you can, your tabletop can be, you're looking at, okay, we're going to have a roadside start right here. The wind conditions are this. And you can go in and, I mean, you can dump, like simulate aircraft and simulate a hand line or a back burn. And it's taken all those into account with the way the fire is spreading. It's a really good training tool.
No, that's awesome. I know you had them last year, and I know, the Western counties in our area, you know, get together, pretty often, although I know y'all have been busy, but talk about the lessons learned. And I haven't heard it, like, y'all have done a lot more coordination, it seems like, this summer. Y'all kind of worked through that last year. But it seems like everything seems to be going really well for you all this summer, this fire season.
Yeah, and a lot of it's just, just talking and communication. And we figured out ways to help each other, because most of us are small shops, you know.
Right.
And so whenever somebody is getting a lot of, you know, an EM in a rural jurisdiction, especially, you know, a lot of EMs, and even me up until we built the EOC last year, your response to a fire or something a lot of times is in the field. And so you're getting hit from all directions with everything. And so you being able to make the calls to all the different counties to see if you can get mutual aid, you know, that's a daunting task. And so that's one of the things that we've set up is if, you know, my neighbor, he needs a bunch of resources, then he may contact me and be the point person to reach out to all the other counties to try and get them resources. That way he's not having to make all those phone calls.
No, that's awesome. I'm glad y'all have that open communication and open coordination.
And then, of course, TFS as well, you know, and
there's
so many TIFMA strike teams and stuff on standby right now.
There's been so much wildfires, you know, across the U.S., up in Canada, New Mexico, of course, California, and of course, Hawaii. It's just, it's just heart-wrenching, you know, to hear the stories and just listening. I've been keeping in touch a lot with what's going on over there in Hawaii and just thinking about the operations
Why is that, Maribel?
Well, no, it's still. So sorry, but yes, we had plans for some Hawaii vacation. You know, of this last several years, we haven't taken really a true vacation for a long period of time. And of course, we made plans to go and celebrate a friend of ours' 40th birthday in Hawaii. And first part's in the Big Island, the second part in Maui. Just listening to all the stories and, okay, do we go? Do we not go? It's not till next month. But I think, you know, we want to definitely be respectful of the locals and the concerns and different operations there. There's just so many different issues, so many different unique issues, you know, being on an island and then working with, you know, the different emergency management offices. And we definitely want to go to help. But as everybody's aware, with any disasters, right, you don't want to be there to impede operations. Is finding an organization, not to self-deploy. But it's been interesting to keep track of what's going on over there.
Well, I mean, imagine the mutual aid. I mean, you're on an island.
But is there there's no mutual aid.
Right. Like, what do you do when you're overwhelmed?
Yeah. How do you bring in resources? You know, I think the different islands are helping out, right? But just in the, you know, during the fire, you know, people jumping in the water and, you know, people saying there was no warning, although I think there was, you know, some IPAWS communication. I'm sure, you know, the incident with the emergency management director there decided not to sound the sirens, but gave his reasoning and still stuck by his decision. You know, we don't know all the things that went into making the decision, but it'd be a tough call. And
we've had this conversation before. I'm not going to armchair quarterback another EM right. on sounding those sirens or not. But like, did you have to? I mean, that's
yeah. Did you see all the smoke? But like, you know, it was, from my understanding, it was so quick, right? Quick moving, and it just, you know, happened so fast. Of course, they were experiencing so strong winds. I don't know. I don't know the community preparedness aspect of it, and the early warning aspect of it. I'm not, you know, too versed on. It would be interesting to go back and kind of just research that portion of it.
Sure, I think it'd be a good after action at some point. I went not too long after it started to try and see. I was curious what started it, and I got two or three articles in, and I was like, I just can't. There were so many conspiracy theories and stuff on what started it, and space lasers and all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't have, like, I can't with this. I just want to know how it started.
Yeah. You never know. I mean, 80, 90 power winds, you know, was it a power line? Was it not? I know the area has already had experienced some drying. I don't know what started it, but
I think it was a security video of a wildlife refuge or something that where there was some sparking, the power went out and stuff. So, you know, at least that video seemed to indicate that it was a blown transformer or something, which happens. We had one of those fires here 2 days ago. Uh-huh. Transformer blew, caught the grass on fire.
Right.
One of our neighbors had a fire start from, I believe it was a train, but like,
yeah, just it's so dry.
Yeah, just spark. A spark or something, you know, so it doesn't take a lot under the right conditions to start a fire.
Yeah. And then yeah,
some of our neighbors have had fire bugs going around, which I just don't understand. Why would you do that?
They have what?
Fire bugs, the people that start fires on purpose.
Oh, that's crazy.
Sorry. That's I guess a slang term for it.
Yeah, but then you think of tourists that were there. I mean, do they know how to receive warning? I mean, you know, in our area, we have a bunch of tourists that come in. That's always worried me. You know, we have different ways. We always encourage, right, people to have multiple ways to get warned. But did they? And do they know where to go? And then you're looking at the infrastructure, you know, one way in, one way out. Just so many unique challenges.
Yeah, I mean, where do you go? I can imagine. You know, we call for mutual aid. Hey, do you have a strike team available, or do you have a tanker available? I need, you know, hand crew. I need this. You know, if your neighbor has that available, then you got to know if you have a ship to bring them over. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, how are you going to get the help there? And it's, you can't, you know, I mean, like you mentioned, people jumping in the water to get away from it. You're on an island.
Right.
That's it. I mean, my heart goes out to them and the EMs definitely that are there, all the first responders, of course, you know, a lot of loss of life.
Right. Just a, and I'm just sure many of those tragedy. People work in the incident, right? Locals lost their homes too, which makes it even harder.
That's such a good point. You know, we have in the state here, we have the incident management teams and if you, you know, that's one of the things when you're going through the incident management team training that they really push on, at least in my class, they did. You're there to help. You're there to help, right? You're there to help those local because you're not from mm-hmm. there.
Right.
Those people are dealing not only professionally with the disaster, but they're dealing with it personally. And you're right. there to go and let them go home and take care of their family. And they really put, my instructors really pushed that concept in class. But where are you getting that local, that incident management team when you're on an island?
Right. And I know they're, you know, trying to bring in stuff from the mainland. Of course, FEMA's there, from other islands. But then, you know, Hawaii, what's, you know, their local economy is based on tourism. So do people go? Do they not? But if you tell people not to go, are you hurting them even worse, right? Because people still need to have jobs and a way to live. And if, you know, these hotels or restaurants can't operate because they don't have, you know, the people there, it's more difficult. So it's a very complex situation.
But well, especially during the fire, how do you get there? I would imagine they couldn't fly.
Well, I think the airport's on the other side, on the other side of the island. I don't think it was on the west side.
It wasn't.
No. So there is an airport. Again, that's why they're encouraging tourists at least to cancel travel plans so that people could get on flights, right? Mm-hmm. And go help out.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I mean, it also just goes to show you how different the jurisdictions are. What, you know, again, you're not trying to revisit this argument, but when you're talking about trying to define our profession, how do you define mm-hmm. it when it's so different everywhere else?
Right.
I mean, we don't. We're talking about getting mutual aid from our neighboring counties, and they're on an island. How do they get mutual aid?
Yeah.
And I have no concept of how big it is. I've never been to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Have you ever been there? Was this your first trip?
No, I've been there. It's been like 20 years. Not that I've never been to Maui though. This was going to be our first time in Maui, so we'll see. We'll see if we go. But definitely, if we do go, we're going to again be respectful and make sure that we can help help out in the right ways. Right.
Right. Of course, you know, vacation's supposed to be a break.
I know, but emergency manager, there's no vacation.
That's true.
It's like help each other out. I guess that in essence is vacation, right? You're not doing it at your home. You're doing it at another location. And if it's something that we can help out, then absolutely.
I will say when we landed in Florida and we were driving from, I think we flew into Miami and we mm-hmm. went on vacation to West Palm. And basically the whole way there, it was just storming. I mean, it was like heavy rain. And then, mm-hmm. you know, of course I get the dispatch calls on my phone and there was a fire and my planner was tracking it and sending me updates. And I remember at one point thinking, how is this getting so out of control when it's pouring down rain? I forgot I was in Florida.
You're in Florida. You're dealing with the incident. But,
it was kind of comical because I could not figure out for the life of me how the fire was getting so big so fast while it's pouring down rain. Because it wasn't the thunderstorm lightning rain. It was like soaking, pouring rain.
Oh, the good rain.
Yeah, the rain that we weren't getting back home.
One day we'll get back to that. I think it's really going to be a bad winter. This is me. This is a meteorologist, Cody. I don't know. Usually when we have these types of summers, it may be a harsh winter. So you'll be in winter weather ops.
By harsh, what type of harsh are you referring to?
Cold and snowy.
Yeah. So my wife, long range meteorology comes from the Farmer's Almanac.
Oh yeah.
And that's what they're calling for.
Harsh, wet winter. Fun times, but that is a life of emergency management, right?
What would you rather work, fires or winters?
Oh, I think winters. Fires is just, it's just dealing with, I mean, we're talking about fast spreading fires. No, it's just, you can't get away with it. You can't get away quick enough. I mean, you really have to look at all things. You have to look at roads. And if you have a lot of resources out in the field, have that into consideration. You know, you're talking about tire issues. Do those volunteer firefighters or firefighters have, you know, safety equipment? So if they do get caught in the field, I know that's happened several times in the Panhandle where their equipment failed or truck wouldn't start because of the heat, right? Got, deploy the fire safety blankets. It's just a lot more stressful. Fire's a lot more stressful environment. Where winter, it's like, it's just everything shuts down. That's a slow, usually a slow going event.
Yeah, that's why I like fires better.
You like fires better?
Yeah, I like working fire. If I'm gonna have to,
well, you were a firefighter.
Well, but I wasn't a wildland firefighter. But in the EOC, that's more. If I'm gonna be active in the EOC, I want to be busy. And with fires, we're busy. Until the fire is under control,
It's busy.
And it's still going to go on for a while. You know, a lot of times people don't understand what under control means. It doesn't mean the fire is out.
Right.
It's just not growing.
You're talking about wildland operations. I mean, they are Texas Forest Service crews. That is hard work.
Oh, gosh. Those guys, more power to them. And they don't, you know, they're not getting rich.
No, I'm just like, wow.
But they love their, I mean, those guys that are in, they love the guys and girls. They love their job. They love doing that work. And they're guys right now. I can't even imagine, because sometimes they're going late into the night and then they start early in the morning.
Yeah. It's hot. It's hot enough, you know, in our conditions. I can't imagine with all the gear and then those long hours. It's just, that's tough. It's a tough gig. Underappreciated job, definitely.
Oh, by far. Yeah. 100% with you on that one. And then if something goes wrong, you may be out in the brush.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long way back to a road to get you in an ambulance.
That's hard.
Most of them have fireline medics. Did you know that?
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, that's a smart idea.
They have fireline medics, and then it's called a WPU, I think, a wildland, or W, it's WMU?
Wildland maybe, paramedic unit?
Or yeah, that's it, WPU, a wildland paramedic unit, which is like a gator UTV of some sort.
Oh, wow.
That's to get you from the fire line to the road. Yeah, the med L on a fire scene is busy.
Do you think there's like snakes and spiders they have to deal with?
Oh, gosh,
running
yes.
from the fire? Oh, 100%. Man, no, thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah, the med L, the med L is basically a planner. They're planning for all the contingencies for things to go wrong. And they may move the WPU from this area of the fire to this area of the fire because this crew is going to be harder to access, or, you know. So they're like a planner whose plan is living. It's not like an IEP that's good for the next operational period.
They got to stay alive for this operational period.
Yeah, they're constantly, because as conditions and stuff change, they may move the medical resources around and, you know, different for planning for the incident within an incident. And so, yeah, Med-El on a fire scene is busy.
Maybe we should interview one in a future episode when they're not as busy. When they get a break, they can go on vacation, then we'll have to bring it back for the show.
Yeah, after the wet winter starts, everything's nice and calm.
There you go.
Of course, you know, a lot of people don't realize what the Forest Service is doing when it's wet is they're prepping for live burns, you know, to try and help prevent fires. So they're trying to mitigate the big effects in the future.
Right.
So they don't ever really get a break.
They don't. I've known a few of them, and you know, I just know how often they are on the road. It's hard work and long days and away from family.
And they can be sent anywhere.
Yes.
You know, they're stationed in Mineral Wells up here in our region, and if the problem's in the Panhandle, then hey, go to the Panhandle.
Yeah.
You'll be back in 2 weeks. You know, so yeah, they're very underappreciated, underpaid. If you have anything to do with, allocating state funds to paying wildland firefighters and you're listening, then they don't make enough.
Sounds like a NACO panel presentation, Cody.
I think that'd have to be TAC for the state because most of them are all state funded. Yeah. But yeah, no, you're not wrong. That's, but you know, we've heard that. And again, we could talk about this for a while, but what service profession is paid well?
Right. That is kind of sad. I know a lot of the first responders, right, they get the overtime, which is really kind of what they bank on. But for the majority, it's they put their heart in it. You're talking to individuals that are in it to serve people, to protect people, for the community. They have a passion for it. And even if they don't get the pay, they're going to do it right.
Well, isn't that what makes it service, though?
Right.
You know, and people also, you're not paid for what you, yeah, but that's, isn't that kind of what makes it what it is, you know? Right. I don't know.
And you still want to be fair to people, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I'm not saying don't act. But maybe that's the excuse I've come up with to deal with the fact that I've always been in a service profession and not paid very well.
It's like I'm doing it for the service.
Right. I feel good when I go to bed at night.
There you go. I did all I could.
Until Friday and I have to pay bills, and then I don't feel good anymore.
True. True.
Then I'm depressed for a couple of days. But no, there's a lot with the wildland, and a lot of structural departments have trained wildland people and they send them out for those deployments. And so that's a good thing.
That's good. Do your water bridges train with Texas Forest Service?
So we've actually got training scheduled next year for that. They go out quite a bit, but we've got quite a bit more actual training. TFS is going to come in and do like heavy equipment training and stuff like that. So, and there's a few departments that have like up armored wildland fighting dozers and stuff like that.
Okay.
So yeah, we're really looking to grow that local capacity. Not because we don't like TFS, but you know, there've been a few days in the last month that if we had something big pop off, we were hours before we would get a TFS dozer because they were all committed.
Because they were, busy.
So.
Which is kind of scary, right? Because, then you rely on your mutual aid resources. But what if mutual aids, you know, they're working their own fires? Then I guess that's when you come in and try to get some more state assets or other state assets, right?
Right. Yeah. So, anytime we can grow local capacity, that's a good day. And that doesn't mean we're not going to use, our mutual aid partners if we need to. But if we can grow it, then why not? And then after a big, busy wildfire season, that's a good time to work on that capacity because it's fresh in everybody's mind.
Right. Right. Well, I really do hope that it kind of, it does slow down for you, knock on wood, and we get some rain. I haven't looked a couple of weeks out. I know there was a tropical system possibly coming in on Tuesday, although I think that was further south for the state. But maybe we'll get some moisture up here.
Maybe so. But fire is a good thing in that it cleanses the earth, right? And so
part of the natural cycle, right?
A lot of times, that's the thing to keep in mind is when you have a slow fire year and it's like, oh, we're fortunate we didn't burn a lot this year, and it's like, it was pretty humid most of the year. This would have been a good year for fires to start, because eventually that's going to burn. Yeah. And in every year that you don't have very many, it's just that much more vegetation that's available.
True.
So it's a catch 22. Obviously you don't want people busy all the time, but I know up here we're looking at a lot of mitigation for wildfire type events and looking at doing some control burns and stuff. So that's definitely something I would encourage if you deal with fire a lot to look into those efforts.
Absolutely. Cause that's what makes it disasters when it hits homes or hits businesses, right? You want to make sure you try to mitigate, do some of that, fire resistant mitigation. I know there's a lot of documentation on that, brochures of what you can do around your home. So if there was a wildfire, at least slow it down, right?
Well, and a lot of people don't realize the Forest Service, they triage homes. Mm-hmm. And so and what they look at is defensible space. If your home has a lot of defensible space, then they're going to put a lot more into defending your home. Mm-hmm. But if you've got, you know, vegetation all around your home and, you know, I'm not an expert on it, but, you know, you've got a wooden fence right up against your home and all that right. stuff, then that's considered non-defensible. There's nothing we can do to keep the fire off of you.
Right. And so, I believe they sell like roofing materials, right, that are a little bit more resistant to some of the embers and stuff like that.
Well, I think even the vents on your home having guards over them, that's mm-hmm. one, because then the embers, as the fire comes close and you've got a lot of, you know, just embers flying, they don't get up into the attic.
Mm. Yes.
You know, so there's a lot there. If you live in a, what the term is, a WUI, a wildland urban interface, mm-hmm. then that's something you definitely need to pay attention to, is how to create defensible space around your home.
Sounds like a great topic for community preparedness, September National Preparedness Month, right?
That's I know right. a lot of EM That's coming offices up on will us be. Too, yeah.
Yes. Some good things for us to consider on public education wise is how we can create that defensible space around our homes and our communities. I know even some jurisdictions look at do some brush clearing around the ETJ, do some mitigation actions around cities or communities. So sounds like we can do a lot of promotion on that. Within our emergency management agencies coming every day, but especially coming up next month.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe if things slow down by September, maybe we can get somebody from the Forest Service to talk about that some for Preparedness Month. That would be that'd be a good episode.
Sounds like a plan.
Well, folks, hopefully we are back on track. I knew that it had gone too long when I had someone tell me they were suffering withdrawal.
we took the summer off, but not really. We were just busy.
We intentionally took 1 month off. There was a lot going on that month.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully we're back on track. We appreciate the support. I tell you, you know, it was good, I think, Maribel, for me, is hearing from people and like, hey, when's the next episode? When's the next episode? So, you know,
so thankful for our people that listen. Thank you.
Yeah, it was definitely nice to know that we were missed.
Right.
So, absolutely. That's I think we've that's enough for today. What about you?
Sounds good. Hope everybody has a great rest of the day, or I don't know whenever you're listening to this. So rest of the week. How should I say that?
I'm sitting here wondering, you know, it's so we'll throw it out there. It's 5:10 right now, Texas Central Time. And I'm more amazed that we made it through recording without me having to stop to deal with a fire.
I am too. I thought I heard some sound in the background, but I was like, oh no, did he get just paged? But it may have been your son actually.
Yeah, you probably heard Madison.
It's like, oh, he's having fun.
Yeah, because I'm at home, but I was, when we started, and was like, hey, let's record real quick, it was after we started that I realized what time it was, and I'm like, we picked a terrible time. This is like prime start time.
Oh no.
But we made it.
Well, hopefully no more fires, Cody. And if anything, you need mutual aid, we've got you.
Yep. I know who to call for sure. So
good deal.
Hopefully everybody else is staying safe and that we can stay back on track.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
All right. Take care out there. Thanks.